So, welcome back to Enemy Combatant Radio. In the studio with us is filmmaker Nick Hill, and on the telephone is filmmaker Bill Daniel, both of whom, I don't know, did you both premiere, or Nick, were you premiering your piece by piece at ATA?
Yeah, pretty much. It was the first time.
All right, so we had two premieres at ATA on Saturday night, Piece by Piece by Nick Hill, and Who is Bozo Texino by Bill Daniel, as part of the Other Cinema series. So can you hear me okay, Bill, and everything?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, great. So first I'd like to ask you both how you got interested in the subject. Are either of you graffiti artists? And Daniel, are you a rail rider?
I'm not a graffiti artist, but I am a rail rider. I occasionally throw my name up on a train or do some messing around on trains. But like I'd say, I'm a reader, not a writer.
And how about you, Nick?
At one time, I was doing a lot of graffiti in San Francisco, and that's why I got interested in making a documentary about the culture.
But you're currently
now
on hiatus?
Now I'm just a filmmaker, yeah.
And Bill, are you still riding the rails? Or?
No, last trip I took was in 1999, but I may get out again pretty soon.
Okay, good. You both spent very long periods of time working on your documentaries. John, you spent 5 years, and Bill, you've been working on this for 20 years plus, right? Can you describe Can you describe your working process a little bit? How you met the people you interviewed, how you collected your imagery, that kind of thing? Either one of you can go.
Okay, well, I'll start. I've been filming and editing piece by piece for the past 5 years, and it's kind of started as a school project where it was just like it was supposed to be like a 5-minute piece, and I ended up meeting the right people. It really like inspired me to like keep going with it, and like it was cool because they, you know, through the movement, they kind of introduced me to more writers, and word of mouth, I just met tons of people and kept doing interviews and collecting all the archival footage and then putting it together.
So it started as a 5-minute piece. So what is, do you still have the 5-minute piece?
No, I think I probably got rid of that, lost it at some point.
And how about you, Bill? How has 20 years unfolded in the making of this film?
It started out just as a still photo project, and I made a little Xerox scene, and then decided to make a film, and I thought it would be about 15 minutes long, and I just recently found like the first grant I wrote for it, a Film Arts Foundation grant, and it's like, personal film, 15 minutes, Super 8 only, you know, and then but I basically just couldn't stop, you know. It's like Nick, I kept meeting more people, the story kept growing. It was kind of impossible to say no or put on the brakes.
And how were you meeting these people? You were just through riding on the trains and taking pictures and...
Yeah, I'd just ride around the country with Bolex and a tape recorder and just meet people. And actually, I met a lot of people I didn't end up interviewing because, you know, things were too hectic or I didn't think they would, you know, respond well to the camera. But then the graffiti writers themselves are people that I met not by writing, not so much by chance, but more like just through contacts, through the mail, you know, stuff like that.
And did either of you experience any hesitance in your subjects to being filmed?
Yeah, I did, definitely. You know, I had to track people down that really don't like to be on film or don't like to, like, be... Because through graffiti, you really shouldn't tell people who you are. You know, it's more of a thing you do at night and sort of you're not connected to it. So that was one of the biggest challenges for me, is, like, gaining the credibility and the trust of my subjects, but... You know, after about 5 years of meeting people and proving that I was down, that's how it all came together.
How about you, Bill?
Yeah, a couple of the old-timers had already been retired and had already, one of them had particularly been outed and actually come out to the press and had a pretty high profile. So he was totally into it. And another guy, you know, he's so obscure that nobody else would ever find him, and he's really old also, and so he didn't have a problem. But definitely a couple of them, one in particular, like we did an interview, we had a great time, you know, threw up a bunch of drawings, and then said, oh, you know, if anybody saw this, I'd lose my job. So I go, okay. But since then, he's retired, and so there's no problem there now. That's, I guess, the upside of taking so long to make the film. But, yeah, initially, the idea of asking somebody to do that on camera is, you know, it's kind of outside of what it's about, really.
Right, right. So for those of our viewers who didn't get to see the films on Saturday evening, I'm going to start with you, Daniel. Could you talk a little bit or describe the early history of the hobo rail worker graffiti, sort of how it started and who some of the first people were? It's sort of a history that I don't think people really know much of anything about.
Uh-huh. Well, it's this moniker stuff is really traditional, and it definitely goes back at least to the turn of the century, maybe from the beginning of railroads, you know, in the middle of the century before that. I think it started with rail workers who had chalk to mark directions on cars, you know, to tell what tracks are going to be switched on to or which cars need to go to the repair shop. And I think naturally they started, you know, doing drawings and writing their names on them. And the name Bozo Texino dates to around the turn of the century, and it was done without a picture. It was just a name written, and it was kind of a collective thing like Kilroy was in World War II. You know, it was a nickname that a lot of people would write. It was a kind of a collective identity. Mm. And so the hobos kind of picked up on that, too, and developed their own language of symbols to communicate conditions, good places to camp, and things like that. Now, that language is since dead. I think it probably died off in the 40s or maybe made it into the 50s. But the practice of doing a moniker, you know, your name and a little quick drawing, that's been consistent, you know, from the beginning through now.
And Parker, could you talk about the inception of modern urban graffiti a little bit?
Sure. I think the West Coast caught on to graffiti a little bit behind the East Coast. East Coast started, of course, in New York, or possibly Philadelphia with Cornbread. But as far as the West Coast, it started, at least in San Francisco, by the Cholo riders in the Mission District, where we are right now. And after that, it kind of evolved when in the mid-'80s, early 80s, when the documentaries like Style Wars and films like, you know, Style or Wild Style were aired to the West Coast. And a lot of kids saw that, and that kind of like showed hip-hop culture to this part of the country. And that inspired a lot of kids to go out and do graffiti because they saw that. And that's when like the modern sort of hip-hop graffiti came to San Francisco. And then it kind of took off from there.
And was there anything, so what happened in between, like the 1930s and the 1980s? Was it just a continuation of the Cholo work?
Well, the Cholo stuff started in the 70s. And before that, I think there was just normal, like, bathroom graffiti, like so-and-so loves so-and-so or whatever. And then, you know, Cholo was like the first evolved style. It was like really blocky. It still exists today in certain hoods. You'll notice it. It's very traditional. And that's something sort of different than modern hip-hop graffiti, but they are somehow linked.
So I'm really curious to hear from both of you on whether you see any sort of direct connection between the work of the rail workers and the hobos and modern-day urban graffiti.
You want to start on that, Bill?
They share the same canvas, you know, now that aerosol riders have moved on to the freights. So they differ a lot in form and scale and material, you know, one being aerosol and being these really large-scale, all colorful, really intricate, you know, almost abstract things versus these things that are done in chalk or paint stick and really simple and really traditional. But once you start talking to these old-timers, you find out that their motivations and kind of their own personal reasons for doing the work is exactly the same as the kids with the aerosol can. So it's really interesting how they come from totally different directions but have the same kind of personal motivations and end up with work that's so different looking.
Did you hear anything in interviewing some of the old-timers, did you hear any reaction from them if they, you know, they were used to putting their moniker on the train and suddenly the train comes back and there's all this bright, colorful spray paint graffiti all over it?
there's definitely a lot of the old-timer guys that are not into that, and they can't deal with it, and society is crumbling, and who are these gangbangers, and there's just a lot of latent and not-so-latent racism among, you know, these old blue-collar kind of guys. So it's a culture that they don't know anything about, that they don't have any contact with, because they live in these small towns in the middle of nowhere, and they see this stuff, and it's threatening, or it represents, you know, this kind of culture that they don't know anything about, and they think it's all based in, you know, gangs and, you know, kind of the typical misunderstandings. But just like all people, there's going to be people who are more thoughtful or open-minded and able to look at something and go, oh, you know, these things are actually really beautiful if you look at them. And I hear that from both tramps and rail workers, you know, that they have an appreciation for it, even though it's so alien to them. But there's definitely a resentment that the aerosol takes up so much space on the trains, and then it covers up a lot of the smaller and especially older works. It's like, why can't these kids leave a little extra space, you know?
How about you?
Same question?
Yeah.
Well, pretty much I think writing is writing. You know, it's like you leave your presence on something. You try to do it as much. It's like some form of communication that it's nonverbal. So I think, you know, the train hobo graffiti is pretty much the same as modern urban hip-hop graffiti.
Have you known anyone, any urban graffiti artists who might have taken notice of the work on the freight trains or been influenced in any way by that?
Yeah, most definitely. While I was making Piece by Piece, I was trading photos with people from all over the country, and I'd trade photos with people who just took photos of train graffiti. So they would not only photograph the pieces, but they'd also photograph the monikers of the hobo work. And sometimes, I mean, that's where I learned about it. I got some packages in the mail, and I'd be like, well, what's this, you know? But it's pretty interesting stuff, and I think the two are so directly linked that they both should be documented, and it's dope.
Did anybody send you Bozo Texino?
Yeah, I already knew Bozo Texino because, I mean, I already have a few of those photos at my house. And, in fact, there's a lot of people that make zines of just freight monikers. So it's respected in the graffiti community by those that know.
Bill, I wanted to ask you a question about the process of making this film, because it took you so long. And did you? It sounded in your presentation or Q&A session after the film at ATA that you went on this quest to find the person who was tagging Bozo Texino. And can you kind of describe how at the end you found him and how that felt, and when you eventually met this person, if he kind of was the character that you were imagining he was, or was the shock? What was it like to finally find this person?
Yeah, it's a good question, and kind of all aspects of that question are kind of embedded in the film and kind of drive it, as it was from my experience making the film. I thought, when I first saw the drawing, I was just hooked on it. I was like, wow, who could this be? You know, I really thought they were all hobos at that time. And when I finally did meet the Bozo Texino character, the modern one, in a way it was this letdown, because he's just this, you know, old rail worker guy, and he just happened to do this all his life, and he never traveled around. You know, he worked on the railroad, and that's pretty much it. So in a sense, there was this letdown of the reality behind the image. But as it turns out, he's a really fascinating character, and was a great interview subject, and had a great personal history, like working in the oil fields, and, you know, there could be a whole other documentary about him. But it did set me up for a problem in the film that, even though I had this narrative device, this, you know, this quest for this identity that helped me arrange the material and build a narrative, there's no payoff, you know, or the payoff is, you know, it can't keep up with, you know, supporting a whole film or people's imaginations. Like, wow, what's going to happen when we find the guy? It's like, oh, well, he did 30,000 in 1 year and burnt himself out, kind of, you know, or, you know. So, yeah. And I've had the comment like, oh, you know, why destroy the mystery? Then you ruin it. And that's another issue that I grappled with the whole way through the project. And so in the film, I try not to tell too much. Yeah.
How did you find him, for the listeners that don't know exactly?
Say that again?
How did you find the graffiti, the tagger who tagged Bozo Texino?
Bozo I found through a friend of mine did a story on me in the Houston Chronicle in the paper there. And because I had an idea he was from the Houston area. And so for like 2 weeks after, and they printed my address in the article. So for 2 weeks after the article came out, my mailbox was just filled with letters from people who had speculated on who he was, but nobody really knew anything. And then finally I got this letter from him, and so it was a great revelation. And I ended up going to Texas really quick and meeting him, and I filmed him a few times, actually. But that was, you know, just the power of mass media, I guess you'd say, you know, in a newspaper story. But others I found out more through kind of weird happenstance or, you know, luck.
Another thing that I thought was kind of very interesting in your film was at one point one of the old-time hobos refers to, you know, the newer crusty punk type freight train hoppers, and we kind of touched upon that when we were talking about the graffiti artists and the hobo taggers. How you're probably, I'm speculating on your age, but you're probably somewhere between the two. And how is the interaction between the old-time hobos and nowadays kid freight train hoppers?
There's it's a culture clash, kind of like the old-time rail workers and the aerosol kids. So in one sense, they see them, they look at them, and they don't understand them. They're like, oh, you know, kids today, you know, they wear their hair so short or whatever, you know, they can't figure it out. And they've got some pretty, I don't know, funny slang, like they call them Flintstones. Like these old-time tramps call the crusty punks Flintstones. But among the old-timers, a lot of them do respect what they're doing. Like that guy I interviewed said, he says, I don't criticize them and I don't stand in their way. And I thought that was a really enlightened and generous way of looking at a new generation coming up. It's like, yeah, you know, it's time for them to have their day and let them have it, you know. And I think that a lot of the new breed, as they're called, really embody some of the best things of the old school hobos, which was all kind of mythologized to begin with. So, you know, who's to say what hoboing really is supposed to be? But I think, and I think a lot of the old timers recognize that they are kind of the embodiment of that spirit now.
Is the younger generation still tagging the freight trains also?
If you're talking about younger generation rail riders,
right.
Yeah, they're definitely they're influenced kind of by both sides because they're the younger generation and they're, you know, they're kind of a part of music and pop culture. They understand what, you know, they're you know, if not aficionados, they're at least, you know, kind of from the same generation of aerosol graffiti artists these days. But they're also influenced by the old school monikers, and most of the kids, most of the, you know, the Flintstones do monikers that are in the old school tradition with paint sticks or chalk, small scale things, but they generally refer to, you know, being punks or squatters or anarchists, gender politics, you know, all kinds of ideas, you know, they kind of formulate into these drawings.
One of the things that really struck me in your film, Daniel, was the use of graffiti as a very specific mode of communication, as a way for people, for a dispersed community, basically, you know, who's cut off from other means of communication, to have this sort of emergent form of communication. I'd be interested to hear from both of you on what you think of graffiti as a very specific means of communication, and maybe as a means of communication for disenfranchised communities.
Nick?
The thing about graffiti is that it's totally free, and you can do it, and you can voice whatever you want, and you are able to communicate your message to anybody that's open to see it. So, you know, most writers just write their names, but sometimes they'll write a message as well. And their audience is huge, because any person like walking down the street can see that and communicate through that. So I think that's pretty important.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the most significant and important and radical thing about graffiti is that freeness that Nick said, that you can do anything, you can say anything. And I think in both, you know, traditional rail monikers and in traditional aerosol stuff, that freedom or the potential to communicate is pretty underutilized, you know. Both of them are aerosol and monikers are kind of folk idioms. You know, they're things that are very much influenced by their past, and they're practiced by people who really cherish the history of it and are participating in it in kind of a, you know, a closed community, even though their work and their dialogue is totally public. I really find kind of most interesting in graffiti is the kind of work that managed to communicate, you know, larger ideas or criticism or political or, you know, revolutionary messages. And especially in these times right now, I'm disappointed that there's not more of a call to arms,
right?
You know, being written on the walls.
Yeah, like most writers just write their name. It's like a fame thing, and it's pretty rare when they go out and put a message up. Mm-hmm. But there are a few writers in San Francisco that do. Like, to name one, like Hart. He has a lot of political graffiti. He especially during the war, there were a few writers that went out and wrote messages on the walls, and I think. You know, average people that don't really understand graffiti culture can connect with that better. And, you know, I think that's truly the power of graffiti. And like Bill said, you know, not that many people do it, and it's kind of unfortunate.
Yeah, Hart's my favorite artist in the city. I completely love his work. And I love the way he references and kind of comes from a traditional graffiti background, but his stuff is so interesting and political, just like completely radically political. It's encouraging to see it when you're walking on the street bummed out about the war and the president and everything, and you see his messages and you just go, yes, thank you, I feel better.
Yeah, like he did one that said SF stops wars right on Market, and I think it's still there actually.
Oh, that thing was huge. God,
yeah.
That was beautiful.
That was dope.
Too bad it didn't turn out to be quite exactly true.
Yeah, true.
We still have a chance. It's still going on.
Yeah, that's right. You're right. Thank you.
So I have to ask you both, one of the things that struck me in both your films was that they were almost entirely absent of women. You want to talk about that, either of you, a little bit?
Yeah, I think at least in the hip-hop graffiti world, it's kind of like a male-dominated thing, which kind of sucks. But it's kind of the way it is right now, at least. Well, one artist that I wanted to track down really bad was Reminisce, who was active in the early and mid-90s, who painted the horses around San Francisco. And I tried contacting her through the connections I had, and I just failed. I wasn't able to get an interview with her. But, you know, on average, there are very few writers who are women, at least in San Francisco. I can name a few, but they're not that prolific.
Mm-hmm. It did seem like at that kind of that early 90s explosion, that main art school thing that happened, that there were a lot of women writing right around that time, but it seems like there's less now on the streets in San Francisco than there were around that time. And there's, you know, Reminisce and Grace, and just it seemed like for a few years there you could look at the imagery and there was so much more, you know, I don't want to say feminine imagery, but imagery that was just, you know, coming from a different perspective altogether. And, yeah, it seems like there's less of that these days.
But in
the rail scene, you know, riding freight trains for a living is gnarly, gnarly business for anybody, and there's not many women doing it. And traditionally, it's been women who ride with men kind of under the protection of a boyfriend or, you know, a daddy kind of dude. But that's kind of changing now with the kids. You know, the punks and the hippies and, you know, the Flintstones, there's a lot more women out, especially in the West Coast, you know, this kind of this progressive idealism that the West Coast seems to embody and create. You see it in train riding, too, because there's more women per capita riding trains now than probably there ever were.
You mentioned that you thought that graffiti was very male-dominated. Do you have any thoughts on why that might be?
Well, like Bill said, it's kind of a dangerous hobby. You know, you have to go out at night, climb rooftops, run from cops, jump over barbed wire and stuff, and I think it's more attractive to males than females. Also, I think in the hip-hop community, it's pretty sexist, you know, even in breakdancing and rap. It's just harder for women to break into those hobbies. I don't agree with it, but I know it's, sometimes it's harder for women to get interested in that kind of thing.
Hmm. Right, or deal with, you know, going out alone in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
yeah. Pretty rough.
I don't
know
how women do that.
Right.
I don't know, I don't quite buy that.
Well, okay, also,
well,
it's like a dominance thing, you know, that maybe mostly it's attractive to males. It's kind of like, it's been compared to like a dog marking territory, like running around and peeing on things. It's like, maybe that's just more attractive to males, like saying like, oh, I want to get that spot. Like, I want to go there and paint that because I want to get it, you know, I want that to be mine, you know. And maybe women on average are less interested in that type of power.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a formulated opinion on the matter. I'm just sort of curious.
Yeah, I'm not saying that women can't write, because, I mean, there's a few really dope female writers all over the country that are really cool. It's just most of the girls that I know aren't that attracted to graffiti. They don't really want to do it for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know if I would reduce it down to, like, oh, that, you know, this is kind of a guy thing that guys like to do and that women aren't necessarily attracted to it, but I do believe that being a woman on the street, is walking down the street, especially at night or especially in dodgy places, is different. Just the women who I know who can go outside and look like a man or pass for a man on one day, you know, by their hair is short and maybe they're wearing guy's clothes, but then they go out the next day with a short skirt and some, you know, cute shoes and some makeup, and, you know, their experience, or at least the way I've had it told, is completely different. Like, when you walk down the street as a woman, the attention that you get and the kind of, a lot of times, threatening or unwarranted or unwanted attention you get is completely different than when you're just a guy walking down the street. So I think that women are still in a lot of ways less free in this society than men.
Bill, I wanted to ask you, because when we saw the film on Saturday, it was a work print, and I'm kind of itching to see it crisp, and I was wondering when you were going to finish it.
Man, I wish I knew I was going to finish it too. Hopefully in the next 2 months. So yeah, I'm still editing and still looking for the money to get everything, you know, transferred and do the sound mix and all that. But yeah, it'll look a lot better than what you saw on Saturday, because it is still, you know, the compressed video signal.
Will you have another screening at ATA, do you think?
I'm sure I'll have it there again, and I'll be touring with it next year, so I'll be all over the place next year.
And Nick, yours was pretty much complete, right?
Yeah, it's like 99.9. There's still a couple little bugs I'm tweaking around, but I'm calling it done, yeah.
Cool. One more thing I wanted to ask about was Proposition 21 and the legal changes and sort of how that may have influenced urban graffiti, and maybe even I doubt it would influence the rail writers, but if it did.
Bill, I heard a rumor that riding on trains is an automatic felony. Is that true? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, Proposition 21 made any damage that you do in California over $400 into an automatic felony. So when you get caught for doing graffiti, you know, they can basically make anything cost $400, like, you know, a door handle and a door. You know, they add everything up really quickly, and it's $400. So you get slapped with a felony charge. And, you know, if you have a decent lawyer or something, you can easily get knocked down to misdemeanors. But if you get caught, you know, a couple times and you're an active writer, you're going to be charged with felonies. And was your question? You're asking how has that changed the?
Yeah, if it's affected the urban graffiti.
I think it acts as a pretty successful deterrent, unfortunately, to a lot of writers because they don't want to risk getting a felony. You know, to them they love it, but at the same time they don't want to risk jeopardizing their future. So, you know, I think it definitely is working, unfortunately, because I'm seeing a lot less graffiti around San Francisco. There's still a ton of kids that are putting in work, and it's really dope to see. But at the same time, there's a lot of awesome writers that are not doing stuff, and I think that's one of the reasons.
And have a lot of people ended up in jail and with big fines? Or is it more just the fear that it will happen?
A lot of fines. They made an example out of a crew called KUK, Kill Until Killed. And those kids are dealing with that right now. They're still in the mix, so I don't know what's going to happen with all that. But they are the ones that are being, like, made the example of, pretty much.
And do you know, is there any sort of movement against this proposition right now? Is there any way people can get involved if they wanted to oppose it?
That I don't know. I remember when it was trying to get passed, a ton of writers went out and, you know, said, don't vote on this, you know, try to put up stencils and whatnot and wheat paste, but obviously that didn't work, and I don't know anything against it right now, but that's a good question.
Would any of you?
Well, that proposition to minimize it just failed, so.
Well, three strikes.
It's all bad.
I didn't really have any more questions. Did you?
No, I don't know.
Did either of you have questions you wanted to ask each other?
No, just good work there.
Yeah, you as well. Awesome.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, both of you. It was a great show, and hopefully we will see more work from you soon.
Can I plug my website?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, if you want to learn more about my film, Piece by Piece, documenting San Francisco graffiti, please go to www.piecebypiecemovie.com.
Daniel, do you have anything to plug?
Yeah. Really?
All right. Well, good luck getting home. And,
cool, thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling.
Later, Bill.
Thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks.
All right.
Cheers, y'all. All right.